start my nuclear watch. Lecture number one, which you can informally call Order of Battle. I also think I'll sit down when I do this. A long time ago I read a thing of history, a biography of the Prince of Wales, the Queen Victoria's consort. And he said that in his lifetime he learned two things only. One, never stand up when you can sit down, and never allow an opportunity to pass water to go by. And I thought how decadent that is and how silly. But after a lifetime of lecturing and conference going, I think it is the ultimate wisdom. Particularly, never stand up when you can sit down. All right, this lecture is designed to give you a sort of quick and dirty history of the Vietnam War. It is an overview, as the title says. You don't really need to take notes on this, or you can if you want, because all that I say here will be treated again in detail and in much more intimate fashion, complete with maps and schematics and handouts and so on. The concept of this lecture is based on a book by Max Eastman, which is called Enjoyment of Laughter. It is a book about humor. And I told you yesterday, I did my last meeting, I did my master's thesis on humor. But in the preface of this book, Eastman, for no discernible or particular reason, has about three paragraphs entitled, How to Write a History of the World. And he said, this is the way you write a history of the world. First, you write it on one page, 500 words maybe. Then you write it as a lengthy essay of, say, 50 to 75 pages. More or less, I would say, like an encyclopedia entry. Third, you write it as a full-size blockbuster book, maybe 1,000 pages. There have been several of these. H.G. Wells did one. And finally, you write the history of the world in 10 volumes, which is, there are several of these. The Will Durant, Ariel Durant, is probably one of the best. The first version of this, the one page, Eastman says, will take you as long to write as will the 10-volume version, if you do it correctly. Because the first version requires enormous compression, stripping down the data, eliminating the less important, trying to decide what you have to leave out, because you're leaving out much. Very difficult to do. This is a general principle in writing. It's more difficult to write succinctly than it is to go on and on and on. William Makepeace Thackeray, in a letter, I think, to one of the Bronte sisters at the end said, P.S., I'm sorry that this letter took so long, is so long, the length of the letter. I didn't have time to write a short one. Well, this lecture is based on that concept. What today I'd like to give you is the essentials of the Vietnam War. The rest of the course I'll try to fill in the details, a sort of a bare-bones treatment of the Vietnam War. All right, the Vietnam War was a 16-year military and political struggle between the communists and the non-communists, fought across the Indochina Peninsula of Southeast Asia, and ending in decisive communist victory in 1975. The principal contenders of this war were the two Vietnams, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, or DRV, in North Vietnam, I guess you can probably see that, headquartered in Hanoi, and the government of Vietnam, or the GVN, headquartered in Saigon. These are loosely called North Vietnam, South Vietnam, or the North and the South in everyday usage. Each of these had their respective armies. The People's Army of Vietnam, PAVN, P-A-V-N, in the North, and the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, or ARVN, in the South. And the communist-dominated in the South, National Liberation Front of South Vietnam, NLF or NLFSV, commonly known as the Viet Cong, which had as its guerrilla force what was called the PLA, People's Liberation Armed Force. Originally it was known as the PLA, then it became the PLAAM, People's Liberation Army, then People's Liberation Armed Force. And North Vietnam's objective in the war was unification of North and South Vietnam under its banner. The Viet Cong objective was a monopoly of political power in the South. We are the sole legitimate representatives of the South Vietnamese people. That was in their letterhead. Now, the GVN, the South Vietnamese, stood in opposition to these two communist objectives. An integral part of the war were the battles for survival or domination in the other two Indo-Chinese countries, the Royal Government of Laos, I think that's on the map, against the communist Pathet Lao, P-A-T-H-E-T, Lao, and the government of Cambodia against the communist Khmer Rouge. Aiding the non-communist forces were the United States, South Korea, Thailand, Philippines, Australia, and New Zealand, all of which sent military and civilian forces, and some 35 other countries which provided economic assistance, the most generous being Japan and West Germany. Aiding the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong were the USSR, Communist China, and East European countries, primarily East Germany and Poland. The origins of the struggle are found in World War II and its aftermath. Japan seized Indochina early in that war in a drive to secure rubber and other vital war materials. This seizure destroyed the colonial system which the French had installed in the late 1800s. It also increased the strategic post-war strategic importance of the region. France attempted to reestablish colonial rule after the war, after World War II, triggering a 9-year Viet Minh War against a united front group led by Ho Chi Minh, but was defeated at the climatic battle of Dien Bien Phu in mid-1954. A conference in Geneva that summer arranged for the departure of the French military forces. It largely ignored existing political problems. The GVN, South Vietnamese, had not been party to the Geneva agreements, and they refused to recognize their legitimacy. Ho Chi Minh, who felt that his victory over the French entitled him or the North Vietnamese or the Communist Party to rule all of Vietnam, but he was pressured by the USSR and China into accepting a tactical retreat and a temporary division of Vietnam. The Geneva Conference thus planted the seeds for an almost certain war to determine Vietnam's future political system. In a sense, that war is still going on. It has been really the essential question in Indochina since this century. Who's going to rule in Vietnam? Is it going to be the French? Is it the Chinese? The communists, the nationalists, the Japanese, it was during World War II, who? And it is temporary, it is now being ruled by Hanoi, but whether that, how permanent that is, what nature of change is still very much an open political and historical question. I think the point of the history lesson here is a very common one, is that present wars are often caused by the outcome of a previous war. The outcome of the Viet Minh War very much was, to a very large degree, a cause of the Vietnam War. The outcome of the Vietnam War was very much, outcome of it was the result of two subsequent wars, the one with China, the Vietnam-China War, 1989, and the Vietnam-Cambodia War in 79. Both of those are 1979. U.S. presence in Vietnam went from nominal in the early Vietnam War days to massive at the early peak in early 1968. The rationale for American involvement shifted over the years, as did American interest in Indochina and its perception of what was happening there. Initial support for the French and then the Zim South Vietnam government grew out of America's experience in World War II, what we thought we learned out of World War II, the so-called Munich syndrome, the notion that aggression which is not stopped early has to be stopped later at a higher cost. The initial involvement in Vietnam was, and decision, policy decisions, were in the hands of Eisenhower and Dulles and Joint Chiefs of Staff, all of whom, I think without any question, agreed to the basic principle of the Munich syndrome. It's a very solid principle, of course. I mean, it's not been overtaken by history, but it's what we told ourselves, what we were doing there, and why we were there. Well, that rationale, partly because these people who made that policy passed from power and they were taken over by the Kennedy generation in the U.S., and for other reasons, this rationale was supplanted in the 1960s by the determination to preserve an ideological balance of power in Asia. The idea here is that no country in Asia, not even the U.S., but not China, typically not China, not Japan, no one should dominate the region, and that it is the interest of each to act collectively to prevent this from happening. I would say this is one of the major reasons for the involvement of the so-called Allied forces. It's why the Koreans were there and why the Thais were there and so on. And in Washington particularly, this was seen as a stop China policy. China was trying to dominate the region, and therefore it is in our national interest and everyone else in Asia to gang up on China. Well, then China turned inward with its cultural revolution, which I'll come back to in a minute. But that they opted out of foreign policy interest to any great degree. They did have, beginning at the so-called Spirit of Bandung, an effort to really extend hegemony throughout the region. But with the Cultural Revolution, which was essentially a political struggle, I'll also say something about that later, I'll say a great deal about it, the Cultural Revolution was really had to do with politics within China, had to do with an age-youth thing, it had to do with a political struggle, life in the bottom of a malted milk mixer, where one Chinese friend in Hong Kong described it when I asked him, what's the Cultural Revolution? Anyway, they became disinterested in the world, really, and so the notion that we had to stop China didn't hold water much anymore. It had very great strength in Washington. William Fulbright's Red Horde thesis, replication of the Korean War. Anyway, that died, and we came up with another rationale. Yeah.
So that balance of power.
Ideological balance of power.
Ideological balance of power notion that took on in the Kennedy administration or later.
No, definitely with Kennedy, right?
Okay.
Yeah. No, it was an old-fashioned, another point, there is a lecture on the Viet Minh War, and the basic point of that is we really didn't pay that much attention to Indochina, at least up to Kennedy. I mean, you can't find anything that Truman hardly ever said. Roosevelt wanted the French out of Indochina. He didn't have anything about getting them out, but it wasn't a really serious effort. No, the ideological balance of power was simply, it's another form of national interest. And that obtains today. We don't want I mean, none of the countries in Asia want the region to be dominated by anybody else. They want a kind of balance, an economic balance of power, political and so on. All right, then we came up with another rationale, which this is mostly under Lyndon Johnson, that what we were doing in Vietnam was to ensure the freedom and the political development of the South Vietnamese people, chiefly through a mechanism called pacification. As the cost of this effort escalated, and the task came to be seen as endless, and particularly after the trauma of the 1968 Tet Offensive, the chief U.S. objective in Vietnam, in effect, became to get out, disengagement. It sought, Vietnamization was the term we used, the strategic term. We sought to disengage under the best possible conditions, not just walk away from it, but walk away from it in a condition in which there, the needs and the interests of the South Vietnamese people in terms of freedom and political development would continue to be served. And that, we judged, had been achieved by 1973, more or less, sort of. 2 years later, however, came the North Vietnamese final military drive and the collapse of South Vietnam. And, as I say, planting the seeds for the mini-wars that followed. The character of the Vietnam War, it's hard to handle. That's one of the problems we have in writing and talking about it. I think one of the best ways is, which may not help thinking too much, but it perhaps does, you try to think of it as many wars of Vietnam. It was a vast collection of wars, in effect. And it was held together by no conceptual concept, no common thread. There was the war of I Drang Valley, when teenage first cab troopers descended from the sky on veterans from Dien Bien Phu, who, many of whom are old enough to be their fathers. There was a 13th century siege battle at Khe Sanh, old-fashioned siege battle, the kind of battle that Charlemagne would have understood. There was the spectacular war of Tet, 1968. There was the so-called People's War, product of Mao thought, this 80-year-old inventor of the Cultural Revolution. There was the war in the cities, the bombs, hand grenades into the theaters and restaurants and embassies. There was the silent war in the villages of assassinations and kidnappings in the night. Secret war in the jungle with booby traps and tiger pits everywhere. There was the war at sea, the war in the rivers and the canals, the war in the air, the chopper war, and going downtown to Hanoi, and close air support for ground troops. And that was only in Vietnam. Then there was the war in America, the living room war, in which television showed us whatever images their cameramen had managed to capture that day. There was the war on the American campus, on Capitol Hill, and abroad, in most of the capitals of the world. The nature of the Vietnam War was such that it lacked any organizing concept that could make it a simple entity, something easily grasped, easily understood. Other wars had an overarching transcendental meaning on both sides, all sides. World War II, for example, by comparison, is relatively simple, elementary. Everybody knew what they were fighting for, who the enemy was, who the allies were, what the name of victory would be. It was all very clear. Maybe it was hard to achieve, but there was no ambiguity as to what victory or defeat meant. And this was not the case in Vietnam. And it was less the case in Korea. Korea should have foreshadowed Vietnam and the way the nature of war unfolded there in a way that we didn't recognize. I should have recognized it, certainly. I was in Korea with the United Nations for about 2 years as a civilian, And when I got to Vietnam, it never really occurred to me to look back at Korea or even World War II. I was in World War II also in the South Pacific. So, but I just took the, I guess it was good in the long run, I took the position that this is a new kind of war, and old wars and rules of old wars don't really apply. And I think that probably is a judgment that will hold up historians. But the nature of the war, being what it was, gave rise to competing perceptions, then and now. I think you're going to hear me use that term, competing perceptions, frequently. In fact, the concept of this course is to teach the war in terms of competing perceptions, not in terms of truth, capital T truth or little t, but in terms of competing perceptions of it. There's two lectures that deal in this in great detail. I think you should also keep in mind in reading and studying this that about the rest of history that was going on at the time of the Vietnam War. I'll have much to say about that later too, but specifically there really were two things. One, there was the formal name, the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, author of which was Mao Zedong. We had, after China's Cultural Revolution, cultural revolutions in the United States, in almost all over almost all first world countries and quite a few second and third world countries, and finally in 1989 cultural revolution in the Leninist countries, Soviet Union and the East European countries. This just an explanation, a sort of a definition of what cultural revolution was, not a description or an analysis of it. The most important point is that in almost all countries, this involved all segments of the culture, and it changed in the United States almost everything in cultural terms. It changed it changed attitudes toward patriotism, changed music styles, length of hair, the age of youth mix, it changed gender relations, it changed racial relations. I mean, it was a great complex of forces. And in the midst of this was the Vietnam War. There is a tendency for people to put all of this Cultural Revolution blame on the Vietnam War, which is really not fair because other countries like France had a Cultural Revolution and they didn't have a Vietnam War. but it's sort of a natural thing. The problem historians and I think people who think about the war have is how do you separate out the Vietnam War from the rest of these forces and events of the Cultural Revolution. They were an integral part of it, clearly. But I think you can argue that this Cultural Revolution would have come had there been no Vietnam War at all. You can argue, you can't prove that, but you can argue it. But anyway, I think it's to maintain perspective. You know, don't take this attitude that the Vietnam War caused all of the world's troubles and American troubles, and particularly Americans in Vietnam, and sort of leaving the Vietnamese out of it. I don't have any easy answer to this, but I just something you should be aware of to caution yourself in whatever you do, write, or think. anything about the Cultural Revolution that you don't understand the definition, not the nature of it, but I mean, is the idea clear, the idea of a Cultural Revolution? Isn't all that esoteric, I guess, but
it's a proletarian revolution, or is that just a China?
Well, in China, it was the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution because Mao rooted it in he rooted it in the youth, in the Red Guard. But yeah, it was a continuation of Leninism, Marxism that. Up until that time, revolutions were caused by proletarians. This wasn't really true, but that was the myth of the Marxists. And this was a continuation of that kind of revolution. Mao believed in a permanent revolution. Kept quoting Thomas Jefferson, which is not what Jefferson meant, but the notion that every generation, the young proletarians, should avoid being part of the ruling class who had taken over and revolt in the permanent revolution. That's where life in the bottom of a malted milk mixer comes in. Finally,
In the States, though, it wasn't necessarily a proletarian revolution, right?
No. That was middle and upper class college kids, for the most part. What's her name? The father ran the San Francisco Examiner, Patty Hearst, which, incidentally, of course, this drew great contempt from the Vietnamese in Hanoi about the radicals in the United States who, they're not proletarian. It's not their fault. It's just they're not proletarian. They're not members of the exploited class. And therefore, they cannot mount a revolution, not the right way. That rationale gets pretty, if you think our rationales for being there gets kind of weird, you should look at the rationales of the other side for why they were actually there, or why they were telling themselves they were there. Finally, one other formative idea that you should keep in the back of your mind when thinking about the Vietnam War, and it really doesn't have much to do with the war itself, it's this concept of social consensus. This, again, is a concept, I mean, the sense of this is what adds meaning and transcendental importance to the Vietnam War, in my opinion. Social consensus is a term that sociologists use mostly to mean three things: that in a society, any society at all, there must be general agreement among the peoples of that society about three things. First, what do we stand for? What is our social vision? What kind of people are we? And how do we differ from other societies in this social vision? And how are we the same? Second, where do we want the society to go? What do we want to become in the long run? What is our long-range social vision? I voted for George Bush, but I can never forgive him for snapping at a reporter on a question saying, what is this social vision stuff? I mean, that's his job, is to provide, I thought. And he tried. I mean, I don't think he really understood the word. But I'm going to meet him. That's what I'm going to try to draw him out in this concept. What did you mean when you said, what do you mean by social vision stuff? Anyway, the third thing in characteristic of social vision, if the society has a social vision and has a goal, a long-range ultimate goal, how do you get there? How do you achieve this social vision? You probably never can achieve it, and it's understood, but you move in that general direction, and it's your guidelines as to what you're trying to make this society into. I would say, as a political scientist, this tends to simply be another word for politics. How do you achieve whatever you want? And about that, there will be, always has been, and always will be, great disputation, and should be, over debate over how we achieve this. The significance here, I think, is that to restore, and I feel this less, I like it as much a problem as it was right after the war, but I felt it very strongly that to restore national mental health in this country, we have to get the war straight in our minds. And that is what we're up to at Texas Tech. That's why I came down here, because of their program, and why I see this, and why I see it as a contribution to a larger transcendental meaning. Namely, it helps Understanding the Vietnam War will help contribute to, in a small way at least, to a firmer establishment of social consensus. The problem with the social consensus is you say to the sociologist, okay, I'll buy all this. Now tell me how you achieve this. And they say, well, we're working on that. All we know is that it takes leadership. You have to have leadership. If you don't have leadership, you're never going to have it. But if you have leadership, then you might get it. But essentially it is a transcendental relation of the leaders of a country to the people of the country. And this applies to totalitarian society too. This is not just democracies. A dictator has to have a kind of sense of social consensus with the people of his society. There has to be some kind of agreement among them, acceptance as to what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. But it's one of the unsolved sociological problems. If you want to really be ambitious in a research paper, why write it on social consensus or some form of it. Okay, well, that's about all that I have to say today. Yes, I'm running quite short. I wanted to do a few other things, explain a few other things, mostly about the Vietnam Center and about the Vietnam Archive. I don't know, any of you been over to the Vietnam Archive? Yeah, well, there are two fellows over there, Jim Ginther and Ron Frankham, who are archivists, and I don't get along with archivists very well. I don't get along with librarians very well. I always feel there's a kind of cold war between me, who wants to use the library, and these librarians and archivists who want you to come in and admire the place and don't touch the books or don't check them out. I'm exaggerating, but there is one of the great debates in academia. Anyway, what you have at the archive is, they have figures on this vary, but I think it's something like 7 million pages of documentation and 20,000 books, which are in a separate holding. They're not in the library. Unfortunately, they're not cataloged, so you can't check them out. But when we get our new building built, which hopefully will be very soon, according to Jim Reckner, then you will be able to do this. There also is a huge collection of graphics, probably 35 or 40,000 maps, schematics, photographs, so on, all of which I shipped down here from Berkeley when we had most of this at the Indochina Archive at UC Berkeley. And to this now has been added in the last, before I got here and since then, a great deal of other material. Most of it on microfilm purchases, unfortunately. Microfilm is awfully hard to work with. The good thing about the stuff I brought down, it's a hard copy original. It's also on microfilm, so it's a lot easier to work with. Anyway, this is described in great detail in this publication. It's the only one I have, and I think they're out of them right now. They've only printed enough for a conference, I'll get you a copy of this each for your own use as soon as they're available. I can pass it out now. You can pass it around if you want, just to get an idea of what it is. And for our magazine, our publication, Indochina Chronology, which is a quarterly, did I mention this last time? Well, this is a publication, an academic publication, aimed at or directed at people who have a professional interest in Vietnam or Indochina, either historically or contemporary terms. This includes academics, journalists, government officials, foreigners, and a lot of in think tanks and schools abroad. 40%, I think, of our mailing list goes abroad, mostly to Asia. And it's, the contents are divided up into, it's been underway for 12 years at Cal, and then we moved it down here. The contents format has been sort of threefold. One, a chronology of events in the previous quarter. Originally, it was almost a day-by-day short description of events in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. We've substituted this down here for a kind of essay for each quarter rather than a chronological. And we're still trying to make up our mind whether this is a good idea or if we drop the whole thing. It's hard to say. The second part, which is probably its most valuable for people, is periodicals and books, publications, in which we have fairly short, annotated descriptions of all the books that were published in the previous quarter. This is where I can even score with a lot of people I haven't. It's apparently the thing that people really like, these nasty things I put in here about people that they don't like. Of course, they don't like the nasty things I say about people. My wife claims that's the only reason I do this, to get my kicks. And I've tried very hard to be objective in this. This is not just a betting of my spleen. Anyway, the first part of this are books, and the second part are periodicals, major articles and important pieces in journals and so on. The concept of this is that if you're in this field and you're working here, you can rely on this to report to you, at least to tell you, what's been published the previous quarter. And that's extremely important for people who are doing writing and publishing, particularly if you're writing on a certain subject and you see here flawed giant Lyndon Johnson and his times. If you're writing a book or something, a paper on Lyndon Johnson, there have been several of these, you want to get this. In particular, this is a pretty good book. It's also very useful for in back issues. And we have, I think, all the back issues. They're also in the internet now for citations. You want to cite a book. You don't have the book in front of you. And you need it in the footnote. This is a very easy way to look it up. And that, I think, is probably the most valuable part of this. The third part is news of the field, personalities, Obit, who died in the previous quarter, conferences, short reports on research underway, and then very recently we have added sort of an addendum to that called History Redu, because we're now at Cal, we were in the Institute of East Asian Studies, which was oriented toward international relations. Here we are much more oriented toward history, so I felt we ought to add something about. So what I've done is do for this is to go back and find little references, historical references, that I think are useful and interesting. You know, one of these is a comment on civilization. Another one on Bob Sherrod, a famous journalist interviewing Lyndon Johnson, telling him, we clean up these villages, we fill in the tunnels, we feed the people, we doctor them, we rebuild their houses, we dig their wells, we start teaching them. But there are 14,000 of these villages, and we've taken care of maybe 100. Then he went on to attack the New York Times. He sneered at Walter Lippmann. He referred several times to Scotty Reston. He was a bureau chief in Washington. In uncomplimentary terms, he said of David Halberstam, he killed Zim. He made us assassinate him. The man is a traitor, so they give him a Pulitzer Prize. They give Pulitzer Prizes to traitors nowadays. Now, but I mean, this is sort of slice of life sort of thing, like the New Yorker used to carry. It doesn't mean very much, but it sort of cuts through the long, lugubrious histories and gives you a, you know, sort of instant picture of this. In this particular case, I made a short thing on what a Vietnamese wrote about Memorial Day in the United States. and how appreciative he was of, he's a Viet Kieu, he lives here, of what. And then another review on Robert Garwood. I don't know if you know who he was, a Marine defector, and two books on him that diametrically. I don't know if this is going to survive the change here or not, but you can get on the, this is free, we distribute it gratis, and you can easily get on the mailing list. In fact, I think probably what I'll do is just give you a, send, put you on the mailing list whether you want to be or not. You can probably use, make use of it for other purposes. The Thai Army, the First Division, Black, what were they called, the Black Watch Division, was sent to Vietnam from Bangkok, and the Thai government got my book Viet Cong and translated it into Thai and gave a copy to every soldier, all, there were, I think 15,000 of them who went to Vietnam. And when I went out to visit these places, they would sometimes would ask me to autograph it, and you'd ask them about this, and one of them said, yeah. I said, you read it? Well, not too much, no. I said, well, what do you use it for? He said, well, you know, we often get very short on toilet paper around here. Well, that's a good answer. the other archive which we have is called Contemporary Events Vietnam. This is put together, it's maintained at the center itself, and its primary use is for putting together the chronology. But since we had it, and since I thought it could be put to other use, we printed this thing which lists the entries and describes them, what you can find in this entry. And it's, I'll also get, when we get copies of this printed, I'll give you those. When this is all, contemporary is the key word. It's only stuff for about the last year and a half. At the end of this year, we will go through this file and we'll take out all the 1997 stuff that's still in there and send it over to the archive. And then next year, we'll take the 98 stuff and so on. So it's really only the last year or up to last 20 months or so that you'll find stuff there. But this is particularly good on economic materials, but it's all contemporary, you understand. If there's nothing much of a historical nature there. For history, you go to the archive. If you're interested in, and I'm not sure you, any of you and what you do here will be that, oriented, but if you're planning to go into business in Vietnam, come on over and go through our economic file. We've got an awful lot of them. Had a guy yesterday who wants to sell rice in the United States and from Vietnam. He spent a lot of time reading about rice production and rice marketing. Let me see. There's one other thing which we don't have enough of, but we have them coming. Is this book, it's a catalog of books from San Francisco. It's called Things Asian. And these are mostly books, publication is run by, was run by a team of this magazine called Destinations Vietnam. Is a beautiful magazine. They're just full of, they're very culturally oriented. Upstairs, they're right around the corner from Macy's. They've got, on the second floor, they have a art museum, or art sales museum, in which they have contemporary and historical art from Indochina, and they, which they buy by the ton in Vietnam and sell in San Francisco. And much of that art, this cover is a good example of it, appeared in the magazine, which they ran for about 2 to 3 years. But now they told me the other day the thing is being folded. I guess they just couldn't get the sales, but they're putting the content on internet. it's mostly travel stuff in this magazine, but it's a very, we've got a complete set of what they did publish, and it's a very good thing to go through if you're going to Vietnam, to go through it. Anyway, this catalog is another project. It's books and videos that they bought in mass in Vietnam and brought back here and offer. And some of it is history-oriented. A lot of it is. But it's quite culturally oriented. Anyway, I called them and asked them to send me about 50 copies of this, and they said they would. I'm trying to think if there's anything else on bibliography that I... some of you have, you know, indicated you wanted to get started on this, and the first thing, as I told you in doing research, is you inspect the literature of the field. That means you go to the bibliographies to see what has been written on whatever it is you're interested in. And that's about all the further I want to go in advice on this right now. Once I get together this handout on doing research, I'll give you that, and we'll probably spend an hour or half an hour discussing it. But if you're really eager to get started, come on over to the center, and I'll talk to you one-on-one on what it is you want to do. Yeah.
I thought I might mention that the city library, the Mahon Library downtown, they do have the 12 or 14 volume videotape collection to be the history.
Yeah.
And those can be checked out online. Yeah.
So do we, and you can check it out. We also have the Walter Cronkite PBS or CBS, which is really just a wrap-up of their 7 o'clock news shows, and then the Canadian 10,000 Day War, which is probably a lot better than the PBS one, except it's so ungodly repetitious from one film to the other. Got Dulles walking out of Geneva, and they're saying something in the next film, they have him walking out of Geneva, and they're saying something else. And the next one, he's saying something totally different from what he said in the first two. But if you like videos, why, we've got them. We also have them at the archive. Yeah.
If anyone's interested, I'd like to form a little discussion group about things pertaining to the class and, you know, literature on Vietnam. If you're interested, just see me after class.
An agitprop operation, right?
Sorry.
Good. Keep my thinking straight. Are you going to have it out in a re-education camp? Or? Okay, anything else?
You know what's going to be at the Southwest Collection over the October 3rd weekend, the Vietnam Archives? You know anything about that?
What was the question about it?
At the Southwest Collection, over the October 3rd, 4th weekend, there's supposed to be a Vietnam Archivist Symposium or something.
Oh, yeah. That was never got off the drafting boards. The archivist decided that there was a national archive meeting in New York or someplace, and which would cut into this. And anyway, they weren't sure they could get many people to it. And anyway, the idea was to get archivists from Vietnam archives there, and they weren't sure they would come. And they had several other good academic bureaucratic reasons. So Jim Ginther or Jim Rechner said, "Okay, we'll forget about it." But it was already announced and, you know, went into publications and so on. But it was strictly meant for archivists. And I don't know if you've ever been to an archivist conference, but I can tell you they're very dull subjects. And all these people have these holdings, and they want to get the holdings from other... Actually, I've only one archivist conference I ever went to was at... in Wisconsin, and they had people from all over saying, "Well, this is really early after the war. What we need is a national archive, academic, at some university, where everybody gives all their stuff to us, and we to that archive." And so everybody said, "That's a great idea." So first guy got up, the University of Kansas. That's where we should send it. Kansas is in the middle of this I'm still in Washington, so I say Washington is obviously the place. It's the center. The guy, people in Berkeley, people in Cornell, the guy in Hawaii said, no, Hawaii, it's very close to Asia. And that's the syndrome, you know. They all thought it was a good idea, but it's this jealousness, jealousy of, well, that's, there's a long history of this. Academic foundations have tried to force universities into doing something like this. We'll give you money if you divide up the field, like the ASEAN field. You take the Philippines, you take Japan, take Indonesia, and everybody else gives everybody their own field. Never got off the drafting boards. You can't even money won't tempt these people. Well, I hope you don't pass on to the archivists and librarians that I'm really hostile to them. I think of them as my ally, like the Vietnamese. Anything else? Any final thoughts, comments? Well, give me a ring if you have a problem.